From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host and producer, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 141, The Georgetown Steam Plant. Electricity went from being a novel concept to an absolute requirement in a startlingly short amount of time. Just 8 years after a Belgian inventor named Zenobe Theophile Grammen demonstrated the first commercially feasible direct current DC dynamo, an American inventor named Thomas Alva Edison unveiled an incandescent bulb in 1879 that used DC current to produce artificial light. This was something so helpful and desirable that it ensured public demand for the still mysterious force that made it possible. After another 3 years, the world's first hydroelectric plant was constructed on the Fox River in Wisconsin. This facility used a dynamo to generate direct current. However, DC's effectiveness declined precipitously with increasing distance and became virtually ineffective once it was more than a mile away from its source. Alternating current, or AC, is a type of electric current that can travel considerably further distances than direct current. Nikola Tesla constructed a comprehensive system of generators, transformers, and motors that produced and utilized AC in the year 1887. George Westinghouse, an industrialist, supported Nikola Tesla and bought many of his patents. He subsequently engaged in a drawn-out conflict with Thomas Edison, who had staked his reputation on direct current. In 1895, the Westinghouse Electric and Manufacturing Company constructed three hydroelectric generators designed by Nikola Tesla at Niagara Falls. These generators were able to send alternating current by wire for a distance of 20 miles to Buffalo, something that direct current was unable to accomplish. Although Edison fought it for years, alternating current eventually won out as the most practical kind of electricity in the United States, and the Georgetown Steam Plant was designed specifically to curate it. In 1886, the Seattle Electric Lighting Company, which was financed by Thomas Edison, constructed a reciprocating steam engine in a shed on Jackson Street. This engine powered a dynamo, which in turn produced direct current for a few adjacent clients and a handful of streetlights. According to popular belief, this was the first central station system for incandescent electric lighting west of the Rocky Mountains. By March of 1889, Frank Osgood, who owned a horse-drawn streetcar service in Seattle, had an electric streetcar system up and running in the city. It was the first of its kind reportedly on the West Coast, and it drew its direct current from a steam plant located on Pike Street. During the Great Seattle Fire, which swept through the city 3 months later, Osgood's streetcars continued to rumble along without interruption. The public's demand for power increased as a result of this demonstration of reliability, and this demand in turn prompted a stampede of investors who were hoping to capitalize. Because direct current could only be used in close proximity to its source, and because young Seattle was teeming with enterprising individuals, a plethora of small, steam-powered electrical plants sprang up all over the city. These plants each only provided service to customers and streetcar lines in their immediate vicinity. However, the process of consolidating control of the city's electric and streetcar networks did not take a very long time at all. After beginning their careers as consulting engineers together, Charles Stone and Edwin Webster went on to oversee one of the greatest electrical and urban transportation companies in the country. At the beginning of the 20th century, they controlled the electric lighting systems, trains, and power plants in a number of different cities as well as six different states. In 1898, their company, Stone & Webster, began looking into doing business in Seattle. They initially collaborated with William J. Grams, who later became Stone & Webster's local agent the following year. Grams founded the Seattle Electric Company on the 19th of January 1900. Within a short amount of time, the company had gathered almost all of the steam power generating plants in the city and placed them under the administration of Stone & Webster. By 1902, Stone & Webster controlled all of the streetcar companies in Seattle as well as practically all of the city's energy generation. Additionally, they had finished the construction of an electric interurban train line that connected Tacoma to Seattle. The Seattle Electric Company and the streetcar and interurban holdings of Stone & Webster were brought together in 1912 to become the Puget Sound Traction Light and Power Company. After the city of Seattle purchased the firm's streetcar lines in the city in 1918, the term traction was dropped from the name of the corporation the following year. Generation of hydroelectric power quickly established itself as the most viable option in the water-rich Pacific Northwest. The Electron Power Plant was finished by Stone and Webster in 1904 and was located in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains to the southeast of Tacoma. The plant consisted of a 10-mile-long wooden flume that brought water from the Puyallup River to an artificial lake. This caused the flow to be channeled into a penstock, which in turn directed the flow over the rotors of a water wheel that was connected to an AC generator by a shaft. Transmission lines were used to send the electricity to Seattle, which was around 50 miles away, as well as Tacoma, which was approximately 32. The hydroelectric facility at Snoqualmie Falls was the first of its kind in the region when it was constructed in 1899, and in 1908, another business owned by Stone and Webster purchased it. In 1910, the business installed a second powerhouse immediately downstream from the falls. 2 years later, in 1911, Stone and Webster completed a hydroelectric project that tapped the White River and formed Lake Taps in Pierce County as a reservoir from which to feed the generators. Even with all of this electricity, there was a significant demand for steam generation. As a result of electricity's growing importance, the maintenance of a steady and sufficient supply became an increasingly pressing concern. Due to the intricate nature of Stone and Webster's electrical grid, there were several potential points of breakdown. It would not be possible to avoid interruptions in supply and the occasional inability to keep up with peak demand if appropriate backup were not available. In addition, Stone and Webster's near total control over Seattle's electric supply was broken up in 1906, putting an end to the company's monopoly. In 1902, the citizens of the city gave a resounding yes vote to a bond measure that would issue $590,000 to finance the construction of a municipal hydroelectric plant on the Cedar River. The Municipal Lighting Department, which would later become Seattle City Light, took over responsibility for the City of Seattle's street lighting circuits from the Seattle Electric Company in 1905 and also began supplying power to the city's people. In order to be reliable in the face of intense competition, Stone and Webster decided to construct significantly more generating capacity than was required. Clarence Begley, an early Seattle historian, summed up the significant role that the company's steam plants played in this endeavor a few decades later as follows. In order to provide for any contingency, 4 powerful steam plants are maintained, 1 each at Tacoma and Everett and 2 in Seattle. This is done despite the fact that water power is so reliable that not 1% of the current is generated annually by the steam plants. However, these are kept in readiness for instant action in the event of an emergency. The service provided by Stone and Webster was never quite perfect, but they tried their best. The first Seattle steam plant was constructed on Post Avenue and Pioneer Square in 1902. In 1906, the Seattle Electric Company purchased 18 acres of land along the east bank of the Duwamish River in Georgetown, which was a separate city at the time but was later annexed by Seattle in 1910. This site was used for the construction of the company's second steam plant in Seattle. The Duwamish River supplied a seemingly infinite supply of water, which was converted into steam and used to cool the condensers that completed the cycle and returned the water to the river, but this time it was substantially warmer. The land there was affordable, and a transmission line from the Electron hydropower plant crossed through the neighborhood already. Car barns and maintenance shops for Stone and Webster were already situated in Georgetown, and the rails of the company's Seattle-Tacoma interurban ran not too far away from the neighborhood. The Seattle Times published an article on the 30th of March 1906 stating that workers had broken ground that day for the construction of the Georgetown steam plant, but it had not yet been decided whether the building should be constructed of steel and brick or reinforced concrete. In addition, the story mentioned that Frank Bunker Gilbreth Sr., a well-known expert in both approaches, had been recruited to design and construct the facility in question. In his childhood, Gilbreth worked as a bricklayer, and he quickly became interested in finding ways to make his job easier and more profitable to perform. While he was observing the other bricklayers at work, he realized that practically all of them performed the job in a somewhat different manner, involving more bending, walking, and reaching than appeared to be required. He devised a methodical strategy that cut the number of motions required to lay a single brick from an average of 18 down to just 5, which resulted in an increase of worker productivity from an average of 125 bricks an hour to more than 350. Gilbreth had finally found the work that he was meant to do, and he went on to have a very successful career in what he referred to as scientific management. In 1904, Gilbreth Muller married Lillian, who herself would go on to acquire a degree in psychology later in life. The couple became perhaps the world's first professional efficiency experts, scrutinizing films of workers to identify wasted effort and optimize output across a variety of industries. their work is credited with being the beginning of the efficiency movement. The word Thirblegs, which is derived from Gilbreth spelt backward, was coined after they discovered 18 fundamental units of activity that, when combined, were capable of completing any particular job. The couple also managed to have a total of 12 children, two of whom went on to write the best-selling novel Cheaper by the Dozen, which is based on their family and was adapted into a film twice. The first was released in 1950, and the second was released in 2003. I can't believe that came out 21 years ago. Anyways, in addition, Gilbreth developed a methodical strategy for construction with reinforced concrete, a material that was initially used for the construction of major buildings in the 1880s. He devised techniques for engineers and laborers that were sequential and detailed how to carry out each phase of the process, beginning with the initial shovelful of dirt and ending with the final product. By 1906, he was widely acknowledged as a preeminent authority on the construction of major reinforced concrete structures, including power plants and dams. Soon after Gilbreth arrived in Seattle, he found that obtaining the requisite structural steel for a brick structure would result in a significant delay due to the amount of time it would take to procure the steel. The city of San Francisco was then struck by a devastating earthquake on the 18th of April 1906. The collapse of multiple steel-framed brick structures in that region provided additional backing for the choice to construct the Georgetown plant out of reinforced concrete, a material that is significantly more resistant to the effects of seismic presses and the vibration caused by heavy machinery. Before the ink on the contract had even had a chance to dry, Gilbreth already had employees excavating the site. The excavators were followed by two pile-driving crews, each of which was tasked with pounding in half of the 1,712 pilings that would be used to hold the structure to the ground. Gilbreth would later write that there was a series of athletic contests begun as the two crews competed with one another to be the first to cross the finish line. On this and other projects, one of the usual practices implemented by Gilbreth was to promote what appeared to be friendly competition between the various workers. Just-in-time methodology was applied to everything that was done at Georgetown. During the process of driving the pilings, the foundation's working designs were being completed, and, as the foundation was being poured, the drawings for the superstructure were being created. Gilbreth sent a freight expert to the mill in Pittsburgh in order to supervise the loading of the material into flat cars and to accompany the shipment all the way back to Seattle. This was done to ensure that the steel reinforcing rods for the concrete would arrive in time. As soon as the shipping began, outside staging was erected on all four sides of the building, reaching the maximum height that was envisioned for it. It was possible to construct the forms for the building's walls and stages using the scaffolding, and concrete could be poured as each level was finished. To transport the lumber, steel reinforcing rods, and mixed concrete from ground level to the location where it was required, a total of four double elevators were utilized. While some employees worked on the external walls from the staging area, others toiled away inside the vast interior, curating steel-reinforced forms for the concrete columns and girders that would ultimately bind the structure together and support the weight of the floors, equipment, and roof. Two tunnels with concrete linings were dug all the way to the Duwamish River. One of these tunnels brought water to be turned into steam and used for cooling, while the other brought back water to the river once it had been cooled and turned back into liquid form. Sometime around the year 1917, a continuing project to channelize the Duwamish shifted the river some distance away from the plant, necessitating the construction of a pumping station for intake water and the lengthening of the outflow tunnel. According to all accounts, the building was carried through to completion with very little in the way of complications. Gilbreth was able to write the following with genuine pleasure in his book Concrete System, which was released in 1908. "We have recently designed, detailed, and constructed and guaranteed for a well-known firm of Boston engineers a power station built entirely of reinforced concrete in Seattle, Washington. Even the coal bunkers, ash hoppers, and girders for the 30 and 50-ton traveling cranes and the six girders of the roof over the engine house, 64 feet 2 inches long, are of concrete. This project was completed for a well-known firm of Boston engineers. It is a good task for our men to examine in order for them to duplicate these points that will make for success on future work because this power station was done inside the required time and below our expected cost, and it is a success from every standpoint." The Georgetown steam plant was designed in the neoclassical revival architectural style, which was a highly exaggerated and colossal style that became popular in the 1880s for government and industrial structures. The entirety of the structure is oriented in a direction that is roughly northwest to southeast and is adjacent to what is now the northwest corner of King County International Airport, whose main runway opened in 1941. The foundation slab of the steam plant measures 80 feet by 218 feet, and the building that it supports comprises two main sections, the boiler house and the engine house, which are separated by a 6-inch thick interior wall of reinforced concrete. The structure's maximum height is 100 feet. The boiler house is the larger of the two sections. It is 153 feet long and 76 feet wide and is divided into four levels. The exterior facade on the west has 9 architectural bays separated by concrete pilasters. At the level of the third floor, each bay has a set of 2 sash windows. Above the windows are recessed shutters that are used for ventilation. The majority of the original equipment in the boiler house was designed to work with coal. A sloped conveyor belt on the exterior of the building's narrow south end carried coal to the fourth floor. From there, the force of gravity alone did almost all of the work. A continuous horizontal conveyor dropped coal from the fourth floor into 8 funnel-shaped bunkers on the third floor, from which it was fed into boilers around the building. The outside conveyor was removed when the permanent usage of coal was put to an end in the 1940s, and the lofty gateway on the south wall of the boiler house was sealed and replaced with a rectangular cast concrete pediment. The smaller engine house is situated perpendicular to the boiler house at the north end of the building. This is the location where the steam that was curated by the boilers was used to generate power, after which it was condensed back into water and released to the Duwamish. Part of the engine house's west facade is split into 3 bays. The middle bay has 2 rows of 3 tall windows per, extending over the main entry doors and crowned at the roofline by a triangular cast concrete pediment with the date 1906. Its left and right bays each have 2 towering sash windows set beneath 2 smaller fixed windows. The north wall's reinforced concrete section has 5 architectural bays but is otherwise unremarkable. Behind this wall is much of the plant's electrical equipment, the switchboard, wire room, circuit breakers, and exciters used to curate an initial magnetic field in the generators. In 1918, a 36-foot extension was added on the eastern end of the engine house to make room for a 10,000-kilowatt generator and other related equipment. Its north face is blank save for 1 small window and an entry door. Lighter masonry sheathed in corrugated metal was used here, at least in part to provide a pressure relief valve in the event of an explosion inside the building. This was not being too cautious. In April of 1908, when the facility was essentially brand new, a steam pipe in the boiler house exploded, curating a deafening noise that could be heard across Georgetown. 10 days later, Chief Engineer George Tucker passed away from scorching burns, and 2 other men were left gravely injured. Before the development of hydropower, the only practical method for generating electricity in commercial quantities was through the use of reciprocating steam engines. Heated water was converted to steam in a pressurized boiler, then piped to a reciprocating engine where it was used to push pistons up and down. This up and down motion had to be converted to rotary motion through a flywheel, which was connected by a shaft to a generator. It was in England in the 1880s that the first practical steam turbine engine was developed. In 1896, Charles Gordon Curtis received a patent for a new design that was 1/8 the weight and 1/10 the size of any that had been developed up to that point in time. This design would revolutionize the steam generation industry, only to be surpassed by something even better just a few years later. Curtis's patents were purchased by General Electric in 1901, and the company kept him on as a consultant to continue developing the design. In 1903, he worked with a GE engineer named William Leroy Emmett to develop a steam turbine that stood on end and was only 25 feet tall, but it generated up to 50,000 kilowatts of electricity, an output that was soon increased. This design became the gold standard for steam generation almost immediately. On the 3rd of August 1907, the first Curtis vertical turbine at the Georgetown steam plant was put through its paces. The turbine itself functioned properly, but the attached generator failed almost immediately and would do so 3 more times in rapid succession. On the 17th of December 1907, a second 8,000-kilowatt vertical turbine was added, but its generator also failed the following month. After intervention by professionals from Stone & Webster's home office, the problems would eventually be resolved. The advancement of turbine and generator technology continued on at a rapid pace. In 1911, the smaller generator at Georgetown was reconfigured to increase its output to 5,000 kilowatts, but Curtis and GE had something better in development. The 36-foot extension that was added to the engine house in 1918 was built to house one of the next generation of steam turbines, a 10,000-kilowatt Curtis. In large part, the Georgetown steam plant was an expensive exercise in preparedness. It was built only to add incrementally to the capacity of the Seattle Electric Company during times of heavy demand or transient interruptions in the supply of hydroelectricity. During the fall and winter of its first years, when low water levels decreased that supply, Georgetown typically operated from 6 to 10 a.m. and from 3 to 8 p.m. Even when it was new, much of its time its boilers were banked and its turbines stood still. In 1930, a significant portion of the Georgetown plant's already insignificant contribution was rendered unnecessary when Puget Sound Power and Light completed its Shuffleton steam plant in Renton. By 1948, the Georgetown plant was operating for only about 100 hours per year. In 1951, Seattle City Light purchased the plant and it produced electricity for the public for the final time during the harsh winter months of 1952-1953. The Northwest's economic growth was powered largely by electricity generated by the force of moving water from the region's abundant rivers, with steam generation playing an ever-decreasing role. The Georgetown steam plant boasts the only two surviving and theoretically operable Curtis vertical steam turbines of the more than 1,000 that were sold by General Electric in the early years of the 20th century. The massive reinforced concrete structure that houses them was one of the first major uses of that new material on the West Coast, designed and built by the now fabled Frank Gilbreth. The plant was designated a National Historical Mechanical Engineering Landmark by the American Society of Mechanical Engineers in 1980 and was designated a National Historic Landmark and a Seattle Historic Landmark in 1984. A significant chapter in the history of electrical and infrastructure development in the Northwest is embodied in the Georgetown steam plant. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include the American Society of Mechanical Engineers, the Seattle Times, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, Seattle.gov, HistoryLink.org, History of Seattle from the Earliest Settlement to the Present Day by Clarence Bagley, the University of Washington Online Archives, and the Pacific Coast Architecture Database website. Thank you for listening to episode 141, The Georgetown Steam Plant. Episode 142 will be released next week. A special thank you goes out to Alan Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next week, I'm your host and producer, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the Ho. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck. The singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck. And Moklips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.